This is the Monday Morning Quarterback Podcast with Andy Benoit and your host, John Engel.
Hello and welcome to an early edition of the MMQB Podcast. I'm John Engel at Engel's Engel on Twitter, along with Andy Benoit at Andy_Benoit. If you want to skip past our Thursday game analysis, you can move to the 18-minute mark. Andy, do you have any special Thanksgiving Day watching plans each year?
You know what I do? I DVR all three games, and I watch the first one before we're the host family. So I watch the first one before everyone comes over, and usually it's a race between the end of the game and people arriving. I remember that when the Texans played the Lions, it went to overtime, and I didn't say hello to anybody for like 45 minutes. But the last two games I watch after everybody leaves, because I've got some family members that just are disruptive, quite frankly, and opinionated and disruptive again. And you know what I did last? Tell me, John, before we'll get started here in a sec, but tell me if you think this is okay, because I've been thinking about this and I grapple with it. I hid the remotes last year.
Oh, my God.
Because I didn't want someone turning on the game live. And there was mainly, it was just some dude that's married into the family that really honestly doesn't talk to
that anybody. Hopefully doesn't listen to the podcast.
He doesn't. He doesn't. And I don't think anyone in the family does. That's why I'm freely speaking like this. But he just sits there. I mean, he's not friendly. He's not social at all. And my thinking was, on a 1 to 10 scale, the games are of significance to him. They're probably about a 3, which Thanksgiving itself is a 2, so I get why he wants to watch the games. But to me, they're like a 9.8, a 10. So
it's football Christmas.
Yeah, and so it's, and I've also got to take notes and stuff for it. I don't want to be watching if I know the outcome. If I'm watching on TV, I'd rather, you know, that's coaches film stuff.
Right.
So I hid the remotes and thought, you know what, to hell with him. It's his problem if he has to talk to someone on Thanksgiving.
You hid the remotes from your own family.
Well, he married into the family.
But he's still family. Do you not count anyone that comes into a family?
I count it, but look, none of them care about. I have a cousin too who probably cares like a 5 out of 10. I just thought because I care so much more.
Well, you realize no one is going to live up to your standards, right? For a football.
Yeah, but it's even if someone cared like a 7, I'd be fine. But I don't know. Here's what I'm going to do this year. I've decided I'm going to watch the Lions Bears game. And then I'm going to play it again as if that's the live one, because I bet these people we're talking about,
and they'll just be chatty.
They won't, and I don't think they'll know the difference. I don't think they'll just see football and assume it's live.
And they'll go, and then I'm going to hide. Who's playing?
Right,
who's playing?
Right, right. And then they'll have an opinion immediately on who's playing.
Right.
But I'm going to hide the remotes while that plays live.
Well, getting right to that Lions game, they're coming off back-to-back losses to conference leaders Arizona and New England. Are we ready to worry about Detroit?
I think so, because for one, I mean, we're seeing them play the quality teams and get beat. And then I'm a big believer in that if you play and you win the game, you won the game. That said, to watch the Lions get beat and pretty thoroughly. I mean, obviously New England beat them quite thoroughly, and those receivers for Detroit could not get open against man coverage. Calvin Johnson versus Browner and Golden Tate versus Darrell Revis. So that's a concern. It's the second week in a row that Johnson has struggled in man coverage. He struggled against Patrick Peterson.
Well, and I don't think that the Lions' offensive struggles have been too big of a secret. We've seen they haven't had a lot of opportunities to score in these last 4 or 5 games. But I think what's a little more surprising is in those last two games, they gave up 300 yards of passing in both. And the only game where the Lions have allowed more than 300 yards passing and still won was against the Saints, and they probably should have lost that game.
Yeah, the defense doesn't play well, then we've seen that it's really not an offense capable of winning a shootout right now. And what I was going to say is I like those slim margin of victories. I'm okay with it, but they had those 3 in a row on tight victories as well, and then they get beat fairly convincingly by the 2 best teams. I think it is the 2 conference leaders, not the best teams, I guess. But I think it is reason for concern. Matthew Stafford was not in rhythm against New England. And again, this is all against man coverage stuff. It's not like they're getting fooled by anything. They're just getting, when you lose against man coverage, you're getting out executed at that point.
So then with the Lions moving forward, are we throwing them out at all?
No, or
you still going to ride this defense? And even if the secondary isn't performing at the peak level that they were?
Well, just because they gave up 300 yards back-to-back games, that doesn't mean that the secondary is falling apart. I mean, it's not playing its best, obviously, and I think your stat's a good one. It indicates that they need this defense versus in the past where we'd be comfortable with Detroit winning the shootouts. But No, I'm not going to just abandon them. I mean, they are 7-4. They did beat Green Bay early in the year, so they have some quality wins to their name.
Those two games did drop Detroit off of that top-ranked defense mark, though.
So oh,
now
did
they're,
it?
They're
who's
now
up
three.
There, who's up there now?
Seattle and San Francisco.
Really? Isn't that interesting?
The way the NFL rolls. So how does Chicago beat this team then? Can they capitalize on some of the same things that New England and Arizona were able to?
Well, New England did a very good job with its route concepts. Brady was excellent getting through his progressions, and he got the ball out very quickly. That's not necessarily Cutler's forte. I think we're going to see Detroit play zone coverage, not man coverage, and they're more of a zone team still. They're not zone like they used to be where it's all zone all the time. But they, under Terrell Austin, they've been more diverse. I think we're going to see the diversity tilt towards quarters coverage, which is a man-zone hybrid kind of thing, and then just some straight zones. Reason being, if you do that, you keep eyes on Jay Cutler, and he's going to – history says, recent history, even long history says, he'll throw a few that you can intercept. And also playing zone keeps – I think it keeps Matt Forte in better check because you're going to have eyes on him, and you can – he's going to get 6 to 8 catches a game underneath, and you want to keep those yards down to under 60 on those or even under 50 or 45 versus letting him get up in the end of the 80s.
The Bears have only beaten one team this season that currently has a record over 500, and now they're coming in with this Lions team, and it doesn't look good for the Bears.
Well,
I mean,
you know,
it's a divisional opponent. And
right, but if you know the Bears win this game, they're up to what? They'd be up to
six and six,
and Detroit be 7-5. I mean, it's an uphill battle for the Bears. I haven't seen their film against Tampa Bay yet. I mean, it's a short week, and we're doing this all a day early. But I'm curious to see that one. It'll be the first Bears home game I've had to watch on film this year, which is unfortunate because it has camera angles. But my guess is the Bears were inconsistent in that game. What I've heard is that they were inconsistent, and that Tampa Bay kind of gave them the game. That's one thing Detroit doesn't do as much anymore. They don't give stuff away. Stafford, while he was not great last week, and his mechanics can be wavering at times, he doesn't turn the ball over a whole lot. At least I don't know what his numbers are, but there hasn't been a lot of – you haven't watched and felt like Stafford's throwing the game away or even giving the opponent many chances in that regard.
Yeah, so on the year, Stafford has 10 interceptions, 5 fumbles. So 15
yeah, so
turnovers.
That's pretty high. And maybe I have to take back what I said, but watching the film, I haven't, and maybe I need to go back and look at my notes, but I haven't seen Stafford throw away games, or he hasn't been as reckless with the ball.
Well, and it probably feels that way because Detroit keeps coming back late, so he's looked better late in the games, and that kind of seems to be a more lasting memory for us. But sometimes when the matchup is as good as this game, you don't need storyline angles. You can just do a straight breakdown with 2-8-3 division rivals jockeying for playoff spots. Playoff positioning, I'd say this is worthy of a straight breakdown, Andy. So let's see Cowboys offense versus the Eagles defense. Same record. How do you see this unfolding?
Well, obviously it all starts with the running game for Dallas these days. And by the way, let's take DeMarco Murray out of the MVP discussion because it's the offensive line that carries that running game. Murray's having a great year. He's a very good runner, but he's very good. He's not a great runner.
So you'd give the award to the
I'd give it to somebody else. I'd give it to a quarterback somewhere. I mean, if it's going to be most valuable player, the 10 most valuable players are quarterbacks, let's be honest. But that's a side note. When I say you take away the running game, though, people think, well, take away DeMarco Murray. You got to do something against the Cowboys blockers. You have to win in the trenches. And Philadelphia has guys that can compete in that sense. Fletcher Cox is excellent. Cedric Thornton is a very good 3-5 technique in a 3-4 defensive end. Benny Logan has good lateral movement for a guy of his size. It's a good front three, and they have decent linebackers as well against the run, and Trent Cole and Connor Barwin's excellent at setting the edge. So I think if you can limit the Cowboys' movement on the ground game, that's your best chance. If Dallas is dictating the terms of engagement, though, Philadelphia has no chance. And something else that they're going to have to do, whether their D-line's winning or not, they will have to get an eighth defender involved in that running defense, which means it's going to be on a safety, Nate Allen or Malcolm Jenkins, to come down the box and make some plays.
Well, and it only took a couple of games for teams to know that it starts by stopping the run. The Cowboys have only thrown for more than 270 yards through the air once this season, and that was the overtime game against Houston. So if you know it's coming, it still hasn't seemed to matter.
No, it hasn't, and that's why it's going to be about 8 men in the box and about these big hogs up front winning battles, and you're not going to hold them to 45 yards on 30 carries. I mean, there's, but you can't, it's about winning on first down. You can't let Dallas dictate the terms of engagement. And so if you can stop them on first down, which Murray has been the best first down back in the league this year, if you can somehow contain them there and get them into second and eight and make them have to make some play calling decisions there, and then obviously you get them in third and long, and that's what every defense aims to do.
What about the other side of the ball? Philadelphia has the ball, Cowboys playing defense. How do you feel in that regard?
They're going to have to play man-to-man because of Philadelphia's tempo. And also, if you don't play man-to-man against the Eagles, they've done such a good job with trips receiver concepts, and especially that furthest inside receiver, the furthest slot receiver, what they call the one receiver, one, two, three, two being the middle receiver out of trips, three being the furthest guy. They do a great job with the one receiver after the snap. And the one receiver, whoever lines up in that slot, doesn't necessarily stay the one. They'll crisscross, and the two becomes the one, the three becomes the one, whatever it is. The Eagles will stress you outside, though, and then beat you going back inside. And I think that's where they're most dangerous. They're very good on the perimeter. We know that. I think you want to make them have to beat you on the perimeter, though. When they're really rolling, we've seen with Matthews lately, the rookie receiver, especially when he and Sanchez have been on the same page, it's when they're getting back between the numbers somehow. And when you do that, if you're doing that against zone coverage, then you're getting linebackers caught in coverage. Maybe a safety if the defense is lucky, but whatever it is, it's an unfavorable matchup. If you play man-to-man, at least you can put, if you're Dallas, you can put your best cornerback, Orlando Scandrick, there inside on whoever's going inside.
Well, and it makes it even harder for a defense to align when that one receiver, like you were talking about in the Chip Kelly offense, is so interchangeable. That's not a,
yeah.
That's not the same guy each time, right?
Correct. And it also can be a tight end or a running back, too. I mean, and Darren Sproles is good, and they brought him out of the backfield a lot more than I thought they would. I was under the impression that he would become kind of their DeSean Jackson and be a horizontal wide receiver for him a lot. He's really been a backfield receiver. He's been good there. He's been effective, so they obviously know what they're doing. But you have to account for him as a possibility. Zach Ertz at tight end is another very good between the numbers crossing pattern type receiver. You don't know who it's going to be, and they're interchangeable after the snap too. It's not just where they line up before the snap; they'll crisscross and really stress you that way, which is also what makes it so hard to play man-to-man against them. Even though I think man is the best approach.
Another high-level matchup. Some feel it's currently the NFL's best rivalry. I would go that way. Let's break this one down: Niners offense versus Seahawks defense.
Yeah, and I guess we're talking about the best two run defenses in the league.
Yeah,
I'm surprised Seattle's run defense ranks that high because they've been very inconsistent against the run this
last
year.
Last week by their you standards. Saw it though, even without me, Bane.
Yeah, without me, they were great last week. And Wagner flashed on film in his first game back after missing 5 weeks. Cam Chancellor, who has not been the same this year, I think injuries are the reason why he flashed like he usually does. Kevin Williams, I thought, looked good at nose tackle or nose shade, which is not his position. He's always been a three technique, very few snaps in his career at the nose. That defense is coming along, and it is getting better as the year goes on. Those cornerbacks have, you know, with Maxwell back, it's a different secondary as well.
And top-ranked defense now, too. Now it shows.
Yeah, it does show. And so I actually wrote in the MMQB piece this week, which is coming out at the same time this podcast, that Seattle's run defense is a little bit suspect still. And, again, that's by their standards. The Niners have to run the ball. They have to challenge that run defense because we've seen with Colin Kaepernick, if you're going to ask him to drop back and be a progression read pocket passer, you're getting an inconsistent passing game that way. We've seen that the last 5 weeks where they've only scored 17 or more points, I think only once, if I'm not mistaken.
So then why has their running attack been so inconsistent? It's either there or it's not. It never seems to be the same week to week.
Yeah, you're right. And I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know if they could tell you the answer to that question. Some of it has to do with, and I am not criticizing the play calling, but some of it has to do with the play calling. They don't always feed the ball steadily to Frank Gore the way you would expect them to, or to Carlos Hyde, now that they've got two of those type of backs in the backfield. I do like that Hyde is becoming their fourth quarter closer, though. I think that's a formula that's really going to work for them moving forward this year, maybe next year if Frank Gore's back. I would expect them to be more consistent in the running game. They certainly have the blockers. They have the personnel packages for it. But we have not seen that at times this year.
Well, and I think that's interesting, too, because the games that they've won and lost, there's not a lot of measurable data there for their rushing attack. I mean, against the Bears, you run for 127 yards and you lose, okay? But you run for 66 yards against the Redskins and you win. So there's no correlation there. Maybe they're just confused.
Well, I would think of one correlation is that I believe the defense was outstanding in both of those games, was it not?
Yes, yes.
So that's, I think when you keep the score like that Washington game you just alluded to, that's almost an artificial outcome or an artificial final score because Robert Griffin was so bad as a dropback passer, and that's something we can get into on a later game in this show. But the defense is keeping them in games right now. And that's a defense, by the way, John, that's getting better as well. It's going to be challenging for Russell Wilson. And I watched that Seattle-Arizona film, and Seattle's offense was good against Arizona. That's a good defense they played against. And the Cardinals are a man-to-man team, and Seattle has struggled against man-to-man this year a lot because they use isolation routes with their wide receivers. They don't do a ton of help route concepts. But what they are reliant on each week is lining up, almost spreading out, and letting Russell Wilson just make plays randomized or when things break down, out of structure, if you will.
Well, and he tends to do that even when he's taken down. So you see a sack in the red zone even against the Cardinals, and he's still trying to get that scramble play. He doesn't shade away from it when things do go bad.
Yeah, he got sacked 7 times in that game. And watching the film, you didn't get the sense that Arizona's pass rush was dominating. They were clearly better than Seattle's offensive line, and it's an offensive line that's banged up right now, and so they're playing some backups. But it wasn't like Arizona's pass rush or their blitz designs were killing Seattle. There were some coverage sacks involved there where it was Wilson trying to make the plays out of structure. Now, where it works for him is, as the game goes on, Wilson becomes a more dangerous scrambler, and not just as a runner scrambler, but also scrambling outside the pocket to make throws. And I think that out-of-structure thing, I don't know if he gets more comfortable with it as the game progresses, or if I don't know what it is, or if he becomes, maybe it's that he becomes more aggressive with it, and he's willing to abandon some of the play designs because the game's getting late and we're just trying to get yards at this point. I don't know. But that's something San Francisco's going to have to be alert for. I think Seattle's going to have a tough time getting away with that in this game. The Niners have a better defense in Arizona, from at least in the front seven, especially with Alden Smith back. And I think they can match up to Wilson. I think they can contain him a little bit.
Well, the 49ers use their edge pass rushing kind of the same way the Kansas City did successfully.
In what way was that?
In being a little less aggressive on the edge. We kind of speculated that they would.
I don't know if San Francisco plays that way because they have speed at linebacker, which Kansas City does as well, but they have speed at linebacker and they have good defense alignment and McDonald and Justin Smith. So I think the concerns with Wilson, and a lot of it, some of it's the read option. You want to, mush rush, that kind of thing, or you have to make the decision as a defender whether to attack or not. I think you decide to attack because you got guys around you. And I would do the same with the pass rush and trust that the speedsters on the back end, like Borland at linebacker, those safeties, I would trust that they could track down Russell Wilson. That's just how I would play if I'm San Francisco.
How about this? A Super Bowl preview according to your preseason and midseason picks for SI. A lot of focus gets placed on these offenses, but Andy, you want to begin on defense when it comes to New England and Green Bay.
Yeah, I do. We talked a little bit in the Thanksgiving game preview of the Detroit part about New England's defense right now and what they did to those Lions. It's not just Detroit that has felt the brunt of New England's man coverage this year. It's a tremendous man-to-man defense, and it's a front seven that's getting better. Akeem Ayers coming on, while he's not dominant, he's given them flexibility in the pass rush because he can come off the edge in their nickel, I'll actually say their nickel base, and he can, it plays also in their dime, and they do a lot with different personnel groupings and dime and nickel and different guys in both of those packages. But he can line up in the A-gaps as well, and they've done some of that. And they've also done A-gap stuff with Dante Hightower and Jamie Collins, who are two very good blitzers. And Hightower might be the most improving player in the league right now over the last 8 weeks. It's fun watching him each week. He's getting better and better to the point where I found myself, when I was watching the Lions film, wondering, what are they going to do when Jerod Mayo comes back? I don't know if there's still going to be a spot for him, if they're going to need him, because Dante Hightower is fitting in so well at inside linebacker now.
What's also improved is that run defense, which against the Bears allowed 153 rushing yards, but in the 3 weeks since has only allowed 153 rushing yards.
Oh, really?
Yeah, isn't that something? And what's also interesting is the Broncos have kind of solved their running troubles a little bit, But they only got 43 against the Patriots. So right after that game, they started to right the ship. What's going on with the run
defense?
So you're
saying people are not running the ball against New England?
They can't. Yes.
You know, that defensive line is very hard to move. Vince Wilfork, obviously, is a force there. And he's probably not having his best season. But, you know, you'd never know that guy's coming off an Achilles injury. I mean, he's not having his worst season either. He's playing at a Pro Bowl level. Chris Jones at tackle, when he gets reps, he's good. Alan Branch has gotten reps, and he's a big body guy. So they have some meaty guys around Wilfork. And then Rob Ninkovich he's not underrated anymore because everybody said he's underrated. So he's getting the respect he deserves, but he's another good run defender. And then I go back, it's Hightower again. Very good. And Collins, really. These guys are very good at taking on blocks and shooting gaps and understanding angles in the running game.
Stopping the run all season long has been a problem for the Packers, though, and we've mentioned that many times. Are they any closer to kind of solving those issues? Maybe Clay Matthews coming inside has helped a little bit?
Yeah, I think it helps a little because it brings athleticism there. You know, one guy who's playing a lot better than he was early in the season, and it's a big difference in their run defense, and I don't know if the numbers reflect it or not, but the film shows it, and I guarantee the way teams are preparing to face the Packers, it's also had an impact. It's changing the way those preparations unfold. And the guy is LaTroy Guyon, came over from Minnesota in the offseason, defensive tackle for them. He's a bigger body as well, but he moves. He's always actually been kind of a finesse player. He's fitting in very well with what they're wanting to do, and he's also been decent as a pass rusher.
Let's go to the offenses. Who has the hotter quarterback right now, and who has the best supporting cast? These are fun.
Well, I don't find this fun. When you get to the very top and you have to pick between 1 and 1A, I mean, that's what we're doing here. I think Aaron Rodgers is the hotter quarterback because he didn't make a lot of plays late in the down or improv plays against Minnesota. So maybe we have to take that into consideration. And the Vikings did a good job with their coverage concepts and did some man-to-man stuff and some hybrid stuff.
Well, the Vikings don't have a terrible secondary either.
No, they don't. They do not. You're correct. You're exactly right. Rodgers is facing another good secondary this week, so it could be challenging for them. But I want to say him still because just 1 week does not make a player. Over the course of the last 2 months or so, which also doesn't make a player, but you just asked who the hottest is. Over the course of the last 2 months, Rodgers has made so many wow plays. Like, that to me is kind of what a hot quarterback does. Brady's playing extremely well in rhythm. He's playing Brady-type football.
Just polished.
Yeah, very, very polished. And that's good, too. I mean, I'll take either one of them. Something that New England does better than Green Bay, or at least they do it more than Green Bay, and it might be because Green Bay has individual weapons at wide receiver they feel they can win with, that they don't have to do these tactics. But New England can create matchups and manufacture offense with stack releases and motion concepts and alignments and the way they just leverage their formations and guys moving before and after the snap, immediately after the snap. They're very good with that, and Brady has an excellent feel for understanding how all of those concepts relate to the coverages that he's seeing. And that's why he gets through his progression so quickly, because when you understand how your routes and all of their wrinkles relate to the coverage you're seeing, then you can quickly eliminate what's not going to be open. And the guys who can see what's not open are the superstar quarterbacks. I don't know if Rodgers is quite one of those guys. I think he has been, but I think when he plays his loosey-goosey style, his playmaker, his sandlot style, I think he gets away from that a little bit. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because he can do things nobody else can do.
Earlier this year, we saw that Patriots team in prime time go into Arrowhead, one of the league's toughest places to play, and get shellacked. Now the Broncos are heading there for prime time. Andy, tell me how the Chiefs could maybe reproduce a similar outcome that we saw back in week 4 against that Patriots team.
What Kansas City did in that game, and remember, New England was not itself obviously coming in. They had offensive line issues. And what Kansas City did was capitalize on those issues by doing reduced fronts, 3 defensive linemen compact all together, almost shoulder to shoulder, squeezed inside. Often, you know, bare fronts are a form of a reduced front that people are familiar with. And that drew one-on-one matchups inside. And then by compressing the interior offensive line, if you're drawing those matchups inside, you're also leaving nobody to help the offensive tackles on the edge. So they got one-on-one matchups across the board, and their pass rushers, Tom Bahaly, Justin Houston, went off the edge against those guys. I think we could see that against Denver. The thing is, Kansas City learned last year that the ball comes out of Manning's hands very quickly. And Denver's offensive line, while it was having its issues in recent weeks and they've had to reshuffle guys in there, it looked very good against Miami last week. I mean, it was dominant on the right side, in fact, where that's where the reshuffling has occurred, with Manny Ramirez at right guard, Luis Vasquez at right tackle. So I don't know if it's a line you necessarily exploit. I think you try to if you're Kansas City. I mean, obviously you want to try to exploit anything. But the Chiefs are going to have to line up and be sound on the back end as well and rely on that pass defense that's been very good statistically this year, but unfortunately now is without its best player again, Eric Berry.
What's interesting is that Chiefs team relied a lot on the run, too, to beat New England, but that was when the run defense was struggling for New England. Denver's coming in with the second best run defense in the league. So.
Well, yeah, that's artificially inflated down.
Because of Manning.
Yeah, because nobody's running against
because
Denver.
Of Manning.
Yeah, Denver's run defense is not special. I don't think it's special. I think it's very good. Terrence Knighton's excellent. I'm not impressed with Sylvester Williams this year, and I thought he got moved a little bit too much against the Dolphins last week. Kansas City will try to run against him. I mean, remember what they did against New England. I don't know why we don't have to parallel everything with the New England game. That was just our intro, I guess. But
Brady Manning. It's all about Brady Manning.
Yeah, everything's Brady Manning. Well, Alex Smith is in that class too, I hear.
Oh, is he?
That's what they want you to believe, because the Chiefs come in with a very similar record to the Broncos.
And a lot of four-yard passes.
The way Alex Smith survives and gets those four-yard passes is misdirection concepts and get the defense flowing one way and go back the other way. And so I think we will see that. I'll be curious to see how Denver plays in coverage this game, because they're a man-to-man team, but I don't know if you want to come out and be man-to-man every single time against the Chiefs, because if you get predictable like that, Andy Reid will have something to out-leverage you there. And so if you change it up just enough, and they changed it up just enough against Miami, in fact, it worked down the stretch. Tannehill was excellent and beat them several times methodically throughout the game, but there were moments late in the game where they needed big plays on defense, and they got it, and those big plays came out of different looks, and they changed things up. So I think you want to be a little more diverse if you're Denver and not let Alex Smith get a beat on your coverages, because if you can make him have to read the coverage, he'll play, I don't want to say timid, but he'll play timid.
Real quick, what's the deal with Denver's running game? It posted 189 yards in those 9 through 11 weeks, and then 201 against Miami.
Yeah.
That's a bit of a jump.
Yeah, that, because you're 189 total, you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's averaging what? I mean, that's
well,
under 100 a game.
When they lose, they average 35.6.
That's it?
That's pretty telling.
On the ground, that's yards.
In the three losses, average of 35.6 rushing yards per game.
Goodness. No, I don't know what the deal is, because they have the same players and they've had the same approach, and that is double teams at the point of attack, and then they like to obviously run when they get numbers, favorable numbers in the box, because teams are concerned with that passing game. They just played better against Miami. They just came out, and you could tell they'd worked on it very diligently in practice, because their first four plays were handoffs north and south between the tackles, and against Miami, that is, and they wanted to establish that attitude run game. I think they made their point, and I think they'll get back to passing. And I know Adam Gase loves passing and is very iffy and just lukewarm about running, but they're not going to go all the way back to passing. I mean, they're going to have to maintain the balance.
A lot of people would be lukewarm with running when you have Peyton Manning.
Yeah, he is a nice passing option for them.
Sticking with these Sunday games, Washington-Indianapolis is kind of a dichotomy of these two quarterbacks that came into the league as 1 and 1A during this evaluation process that we hold so near and dear to our hearts. How has it shook out since then? I think we know the answer.
Well, yeah, Robert Griffin, I mean, do we even it's almost like we don't even remember that Griffin came in with Andrew Luck at times. It feels like we get so
he's
dialed
missed 10
in.
Starts. I mean, the difference is 10 starts. That's big.
Well, and then he's been, I think, very bad at times in the games that he has started, and especially as of late. And Jay Gruden, the previous regime, this is why I always snickered when there was talk about Robert Griffin not liking Mike Shanahan or being on a different page. Mike Shanahan, Griffin will look back on his career and realize that Mike Shanahan was the best thing that ever happened to him, and unfortunately it was short-lived and early in his career. Shanahan catered the offense to Griffin's skills, built around his mobility. I thought maybe not in a – I want to say in a healthy way, but maybe not because they did expose Griffin a bit. But I think Griffin's a guy that's going to get exposed no matter what he does. He doesn't know how to protect his body anyway. And if you have him at least running and on the move, then he's kind of in control. You know, he can kind of tell what to expect from hits. If Shanahan were to ask Griffin to just drop back and throw, Griffin would have gotten more injuries because he gets pile-drived, he gets hit from angles he's not expecting by guys he doesn't see, all that stuff. Jay Gruden's asking him to do that stuff at times, and the Washington offensive line did not play well last week, so Griffin did not get a lot of help, to be fair to him.
That last drive was brutal against San Francisco.
Yeah, because
Justin Smith was on his back the whole time.
Yeah, it was brutal because Washington's not equipped to play if they don't have the running game threat. I mean, if they're just a sing right now, the way Griffin's playing, the offensive play design has to work perfectly for him to have a chance, just to have a chance. And then there are issues in his drop back where it's often not synced with the timing of the routes because his mechanics are sloppy. He's not seeing routes within the timing and construction of the play. And Jay Gruden's not catering the offense to him. They're not doing as many bang play action passes. We're not the pistol has disappeared almost under Gruden. And I'm not criticizing Gruden for that. He's saying because I think his belief, and a lot of coaches would agree, not all coaches, but a lot, the belief is that Griffin's approach early in the career with that pistol stuff and that read option, that was not sustainable. At some point in the NFL, you might become a wild card team with that stuff every year, but at some point in the NFL, a great quarterback, and that's what you draft a guy number two overall to be, if you're going to have a great quarterback, you have to have him drop back in the pocket and make winning plays and go through multiple progressions. And Griffin is being asked to do that under Gruden, and we're seeing now that he cannot do that. And then there's Andrew Luck, who I think is perfect at everything.
If you're going, that's right. If you're going to be selective with these read option packages, though, wouldn't the team to do it against be Indianapolis? Good man coverage defense, not great in the pass rush.
And not particularly athletic on the edges either. Eric Walden's a
bit stiff.
Which is where
it counts with the read option.
Right. Yeah. So that's why I'm backing up your point there. Eric Walden's a bit stiff. Bjorn Warner's a bit stiff. So yeah, it could be, but The big secret right now in football, and it's not a secret on film, is that Robert Griffin doesn't run well anymore. And maybe that's a right now thing. I think we talked about this last week. I know I've certainly written it, and I've said it on DC radio stations a bunch lately. He doesn't run well. Watch him. If you didn't know he was Robert Griffin, you wouldn't think twice about his running.
Which completely limits his game, too, because he's not a pocket quarterback.
Right. We're describing a bad quarterback. That's what we're talking about right now.
And the Colts have a home game. They're sticking in the AFC South Titans-Texans game. Ryan Mallett will be out for the year. Another pocket passing quarterback, Zach Mettenberger, will be going up against that Texans defense. I'll ask you real quick, after a quick early look at both of these quarterbacks, specifically Mettenberger, which one looks more plausible in becoming a long-term starter?
I guess I'd say specifically Mettenberger.
Because he can play.
Right, well, he has a pectoral muscle that's healthy right now. That helps. But Ryan Mallett, I like Mallett. I like some of Mallett's traits. I like the way the offense is conducted by him. I like that he plays on time and within the structure of the designs and Bill O'Brien's system. He has some issues with accuracy that I don't know if those will get cleaned up or not. I didn't watch him in Arkansas, but people I respect are skeptical that they will. He can get by without with iffy accuracy because he does have some wow traits here and there, but he'll have to clean that up if he's to become, if you're going to win playoff games with a guy like him. As far as Mettenberger goes, it's the same thing that we've seen in other weeks. It's a little bit slow to get the progressions down right now, which is to be expected. A little bit slow twitch. I think he has more wow type traits than Mallett, because Mettenberger is willing to make the big time stick throws. He has the mentality of a big time pocket passer. I like his potential more than I like Ryan Mallett's potential. I don't know if either of these guys are your franchise QB or not.
Jumping the Cardinals on the road with the Falcons, did Drew Stanton and the Cardinals and this offense get exposed in that loss to Seattle?
I don't think Drew Stanton got exposed. I think he was confirmed to be what we thought he'd be, and I think Arizona can keep winning with him. He made some nice throws in that game against Seattle. He started out very shaky in the first half and didn't quite see things clearly, wasn't quite on time. Ball placement was inconsistent. But the second half, when he turned it loose, and I liked what he did a few times. They had some penalties, and they got out of time on off schedule on offense, and so they weren't able to overcome that. And that's a little concerning because in the NFL, you're not going to always be on schedule. You are going to face third down and 13 at times, and you have to be competitive in those scenarios, and they weren't necessarily that way against Seattle. So they did have Larry Fitzgerald out in that game. I'm still confident about Arizona's offense overall. I mean, it's a defensive team, no doubt, and it'd be better to have Carson Palmer in there. That is a setback, but I don't think we're about to witness a faceplant by this team.
Bruce Arians is known for being a vertical passing game coach. Last week, though, Drew Stanton was ninth worst in yards per attempt, 5.73. They weren't going downfield. That wasn't an emphasis, and no offensive touchdowns. Did you see a major shift in how the Cardinals were trying to attack that talented Seattle defense?
Oh, boy, I'd have to go. You know, I don't know if I did. I mean, I think the routes were still called there. You know, Seattle's defense played on fire that game. Cliff Avril had his best game of the season. Bruce Irvin had his best game. They were fast. They were too fast for Arizona. When you go up against a unit that's just flat out faster than you across the board, you're not going to get downfield. I don't care what your offense design is. You're not going to stretch the field. So that was a problem. Now, that's not going to be a problem against Atlanta. That Atlanta defense is okay in terms of speed. I mean, Paul Warlew's played faster. Desmond Southward can move a little bit at safety. But, I mean, you know, the Falcons are not going to come out on fire the way Seattle did last week.
Not an intriguing matchup. Giants are 3-8. Jaguars are 1-10. But a new intriguing star is Odell Beckham. We've all seen the catch. For me, a few dozen times, I think I watched it over and over again. We both think that it's one of the greatest catches of all time.
No. For me, it's the greatest. I would hope it'd be for you because you're a little younger than me, so I don't know what catches you've seen that
I haven't
seen.
I haven't seen every catch in pro football history. That's my only problem here.
It's the greatest we've seen, or greatest I've seen.
Right, especially in the last week.
Well, yeah, especially in the last week. Thank you, John. Yeah.
But where does he rank when you're ranking these young wide receivers? He's a rookie. And he could already be up there with your more talented receivers around the league.
Yeah, certainly in terms of just raw talent, I think he's in the discussion with almost every receiver in the league. What does make it a little bit unique and confusing almost is that how do you account for his size? It's nothing special. He's 5'11". He probably weighs a little over 200 pounds. He's not Demaryius Thomas, Calvin Johnson, Julio Jones, Dez Bryant.
He's got bigger hands than Calvin, though.
Yeah, that's a great point, actually. He does. And that's what makes it confusing. He has unique size that's both outstanding and less than impressive at the same time in different parts of his body. I don't know how, you know, I don't know. I tried to think coming into this show, where do I rank Beckham in terms of receivers right now? And I don't think you can do that. There's just not enough sample size. Yeah, it's hard to make. I mean, I don't know how you can do that.
Do you see him evolving into maybe an Antonio Brown kind of player?
That's the guy I was thinking most and comparing most. And if that's the case, if he can evolve in that kind of player, he'll be better than Brown because he has more dynamic traits. Brown, I think, is the best in the league at getting in and out of his breaks. Beckham has the potential to surpass him. But to answer the question, the easier one, where does Beckham rank among the young receivers? Because it's been a great – that receiving class that came in this year, supposedly the deepest and best ever.
Mike Evans, yeah, Kelvin Benjamin.
It's living up. And you're just listing the first-rounders. There's some mid-round guys that have been very good as well. I rank Beckham at the top of the class. I rank Mike Evans second, and I rank Kelvin – well, I got to account for Sammy Watkins.
Oh, yeah, Watkins too.
I think I rank Watkins right behind Evans, and then I rank Benjamin fourth. And Benjamin's so raw. I'm not worried about Watkins developing, and I'm not really worried about Beckham developing. I think they'll become great route runners. They have just because of the tools alone. Evans, you know, that's a guy who might wind up relying on his size throughout his career, a little bit like, Alshon Jeffrey. He might not even be that polished. And Jeffrey's not bad. I'm not taking a shot at him.
It's really hard to compare these smaller wide receivers to the bigger size guys. Like when you're ranking wide receivers, are you really going to put Dez Bryant on the same scale as Odell Beckham Jr.? No, Dez Bryant's a physical freak.
Right. Yeah, they're different types of guys.
He's not a rookie, but another really good route-running young wide receiver, Keenan Allen over there with the Chargers. How does he compare to a guy like Odell Beckham?
Yeah, Allen's excellent, and he hasn't quite had the production that we thought he would have this year, but he's been fine. He's been very good. He's a tough cover, and he's very good late in the down. I think he's a comfortable guy to go to in third down situations. I would rank Allen right up in there in this discussion. I mean, Beckham has more raw talent, but you know, Keenan Allen, we could be talking, John, about the two best route runners in the NFL 3 years from now. In fact, I think we are. I don't know which one.
Beckham
will be one
Jr.
And
Keenan?
Yeah, and Keenan Allen.
Antonio Brown's not going anywhere.
Yeah,
he's
okay,
not
so
just
the
falling
three,
off.
Yeah, I was trying to keep it to the young guys. But we did mention Brown earlier. Okay, the three best route runners 3 years from now, maybe even by this time next year.
Allen and the Chargers will be taking on the Ravens this week in a game with playoff implications. If you had to take one quarterback going forward and it came down to Flacco and Rivers, where would you go?
Well,
they're so different. They're different.
They're similar in a lot of ways too. And I think on the surface, your question sounds weird. I want to say dumb, but it's a weird one because Flacco's so much younger than Rivers. But I know what you're getting at. I know what you're saying because there's no sign that Rivers is slowing down at all. And right, Flacco might have more upside, but you know, Rivers is the more sure thing. And I think that's a very interesting question. It's a fascinating one. I think I'd take Joe Flacco still. And I think a lot of coaches would for this reason. If the guy has the talent, every coach believes that he can harness it and cultivate it. And Flacco has a little bit more raw talent than Phillip Rivers. And he's a better athlete. Rivers moves under, you know, is underrated. But Flacco, you don't have to worry about underrated. He's a good mover. He doesn't look lean. Neither of those guys look like it. But Flacco, 6'6", guy who can move, arguably the strongest arm in the league. I'm taking him.
The mobility's there for Flacco, but like Phillip Rivers this season, they've both been standing in the pocket a lot longer, too. Haven't you seen that Flacco has been willing to take those hits late in the passing down?
He's in a precision timing offense, and when he under Gary Kubiak, and when he is in the pocket, you know, they do a lot of rollout concepts as well, but when they do keep him in the pocket and he's coming back from under center, you saw that. Did you see that stat on Monday night, the Monday night game against the Saints, where Flacco's been in the shotgun 37% this year, least amount in the league. Second lowest is Brian Hoyer at 60%. I mean, it's Flacco's the only – that's for pass percent of pass attempts that come out of the shotgun. Flacco's the only old-school quarterback now these days that drops back. I like what they're doing with him. I think he's getting more comfortable in that system. I think they've gotten – you could argue, and Flacco's always been kind of inconsistent. I don't know why that is. But you could argue he's gotten more comfortable, maybe not by the week, but by the block, by the every 4 weeks so far.
And he's also going up against the Chargers defense that has gotten substantially healthier over the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, with Melvin Ingram back and even Manti Te'o, who's not an explosive player. But
Brandon Flowers was out for a while, too.
Yeah, and is he back now?
Yes.
Okay, so they're getting healthy, and obviously Jason Verrett's not going to be back. That's too bad. But 3 out of 4 is not bad. Those two guys up front, though, with Manti Te'o and Melvin Ingram, there's an explosive element that's returned to the defense. And I'm surprised because Te'o's not that kind of athlete. He's more of a methodical, steady mover. He's going to have to rely on technique and read and react skills. But he looked quick in his first game back. Maybe he's fresh. I don't know if he's fresher than everybody or what that would be. He looked quicker, and I'm curious to see if that holds up. I think Melvin Ingram has a chance to be an elite superstar if used, you know, well, he's going to be used properly because he can do whatever you need him to do if he stays healthy. That's really his key.
Saints Steelers, how about we go with this same question of who would you rather have? Drew Brees, 35 years old. Ben Roethlisberger, 32 years old. Moving forward, who do you want?
I'm building a team around one of them.
Just one of them.
And so I have my options are Brees, who might be getting old, but then Roethlisberger, who could be artificially young because he's taken that Steve McNair type of blow to his body over the course of his career. And at some point, maybe that catches up to him, although we have not seen that catch up to him under Todd Haley in that system. And he's become a more cerebral quarterback, and there's no decline in his skills whatsoever. He still is shedding would-be sackers, and he's not getting hurt doing it anymore. I'm taking Roethlisberger because I think Brees, I think you can see hints of decline in his game. I think the arm strength's become a little bit inconsistent. And this isn't going to last, but some of the decision-making this year has been a little bit bizarre at times, and he doesn't have a great cast around him, which isn't your question, but to answer for this game, I like Roethlisberger for the rest of the season, certainly.
And that Steelers defense, comparatively to the Chargers defense we were just talking about, is also getting a lot healthier right at the perfect time.
Yeah, and they're going to have they potentially will have Jarvis Jones back, Troy Polamalu, Ike Taylor, and Ryan Shazier. That's four quality starters. And in the meantime, something that's the upside of injuries that nobody talks about is you develop great depth from it. And it's not just that guys got to play. It is that the guys got to play, but they get more coaching. They get more reps in practice, more attention. The coaching in the NFL is at such a high level that we see guys, if you plug in a guy, chances are good he's going to improve if he's just getting the reps and he's getting the attention from the coaching staff and being taught the intricacies of the game plan and having to take responsibility for the game plan each week. Now the Steelers have a host of guys like that. It's a much deeper team, and maybe that'll help them keep some of these guys healthy. I wonder if Ike Taylor, I would imagine he'll start and play. The other guys I think will be parts of rotations. They'll get all the snaps. Polamalu is certainly going to play every snap. I wonder if Ike Taylor will play at corner. I think he will because they're pretty thin there. I wonder if he'll start, though.
Browns-Bills, Mike Pettine returning to Buffalo, where he left one of the league's better defenses and now brings in one of the league's rising defenses. Cleveland ranked 20th in defense. Might be a bit deceiving. What do you see coming out of this game?
I see two very similar type of defense. And by the way, on the Ike Taylor thing, I don't know if he's playing this week. I don't want to make it sound like he's back now. But in the big picture, at some point, they're going to be healthy there. As far as the guys like Ike Taylor in this one, you've got Stephon Gilmore at cornerback and Joe Hayden at cornerback. And when you have number one corners like that, and neither has been super consistent this year in terms of superstar standards. They've both been very good, but not quite excellent. But I'll take very good if they can match up to any wide receiver you ask them to match up to. When you have cornerbacks like that, you have the flexibility to do what you want elsewhere. And we've seen these teams do what they want elsewhere schematically. Now, Cleveland's more apt to blitz than Buffalo because they don't have the kind of resources Buffalo has up front. Either way, how you slice it, these are two really well-coached defenses, and a big reason why is because they have star man-to-man corners, plus a good supporting cast in the secondary around them so they can play any coverage they need.
Doesn't Cleveland's ability to blitz change drastically with the loss of Tashaun Gibson, though, moving forward?
I would not say drastically. Gibson's having an excellent season, a bit of a ball hawk, as we know. But I think Dante Whitner's the key to the blitzes because he's the guy that organizes them in the back end. That's why they signed him. And they also have Jim Leonard because of his experience in this kind of scheme. And so I don't know if Leonard will become the new starting safety. My guess is he won't. It's probably going to be.
He came in for Gibson when he
did
went
he come
out.
In? Oh, okay. Yeah. I was thinking maybe it'd be Jordan Poyer at safety. Who's a little bit younger guy, probably Ranger. I don't know. I haven't seen a lot of them, but. If Leonard came in for game, okay, that's fine. However it is, they have those veterans who can blitz and orchestrate stuff. I think they can survive without Gibson for now. It's too bad he's hurt, but I think they can survive that one.
Cincinnati Bengals, Tampa Bay Bucks. Quietly, the Bengals are still sitting in first place in the AFC North somehow, some way, but just with 14 sacks from that defense, second lowest in the league.
Isn't that surprising?
That's weird for a defense that last year was much better than that 10th in the league in sacks when the year came to a close.
Well, and for a defense that does a lot with pressure concepts. We think of the Bengals as that double A gap blitzing team. They really haven't been that as much lately. With Vontaze Burfict out of the lineup, they have not played that way. They've been more read and react, coverage based, and those guys are playing well. The Bengals are really, they're just the epitome of a solid defense. They're solid in their coaching. They're solid in their depth. They're solid in their fundamentals. They're solid in their speed, their strength, their combination of how their talent intertwines with each other, how guys relate to one another. It's a good Bengals defense because there's not a lot of cracks in it. But it's not a dynamic one this year.
So then Bengals on the road against the Bucks, does this help the Bengals move forward in clinching that division, a game like
this?
You
mean, can they get an easy win?
That's kind of what it seems like anymore.
We know, come
when
on,
you
Joe,
play the
we
Bucks.
Have rules on this show.
We do, but when you're 2-9, it's easier to fudge the lines of the rules.
Hey, that 2-9 team is two games out of first place, my friend. They're in the same.
Your favorite to win the division.
Statistically, in a way, you could argue, and it's not a ridiculous argument, you could argue that Tampa Bay is in the same exact playoff position
as the Bengals.
No, I was going to say as
they're
the Niners.
They're right there.
Well, yeah, the Bengals in first place, though. I was
yeah, but
say,
the whole
the,
division has the same damn record. So
no, the Bucks and the Seahawks and Niners are in the same playoff positioning. They're all two games out of first place in their division.
And I would put the Bucks right next to those teams in talent.
Yeah, well, in talent. Now, in execution and orchestration and consistency, they're lacking. No, John, we're not going to be that show that says this is an easy win. We've learned better than that. And recently, come on, with St. Louis and Denver outcome, Oakland, Kansas City outcome, the Bucks and the Steelers earlier this year.
Would you be surprised if the Bucks beat this Bengals team, though?
Oh, I'd be surprised, but I mean, I would not be shocked.
Speaking of the Raiders, what did you think of that win last Thursday night, which would have killed my easy win theory?
Yeah, I think it was well-deserved. I was glad to see it because having watched every Raiders snap this season, I've been impressed with this team a lot for being a lower-end team, of course. They are not a laughing stock. They're not, and they don't deserve to go 0-16. They're not that kind of team. I mean, in fact, talent-wise, execution-wise, they're, and this doesn't sound great, but they're 4-12, 5-11 type team. They're, and I think there's reason for upside in Oakland. You know, we've seen plenty of 4-12 type Raider teams before, but none of them had the quarterback of the future, and now they do have that quarterback. And I hope they stick with him. I hope the new coaching staff, whoever that is, probably the new front office, I hope they stick with Derek Carr. And I like that off. You know, I like the offensive line. I think they need a piece or two, but the core pieces are there. What you have is a quarterback, and I think you've got a chance of protecting him long term.
And you also have probably the worst schedule in the NFL. The only bad
difficulty?
Team they played was Week 1 against the Jets.
I don't think about that stuff.
It has to factor into you saying that this is more of a 4-12 team.
You're supporting my point. All right, good point.
I mean, where do those three wins come against?
I'm not saying they're going to go 4-12. I'm saying that just the way they look on film, they remind me. The quality of a 4-12, which, again, I know that sounds like it probably is. I don't mean it to be a backhanded compliment. But what I'm getting at is this is not a historically bad team. I have seen many teams worse over the years than this Raiders team are. I don't care what the records say.
And that Raiders team does lack playmakers. We talked about Odell Beckham Jr. being one of the best of them earlier. Another impressive rookie wide receiver, Kelvin Benjamin. Interesting matchups here with the Vikings in that secondary, which is pretty talented. What do you think about Benjamin coming into this game?
I think he's got a lot of work to do as a route runner, and he has so many flaws. And there have been multiple weeks where he has discontinued his slant routes that have led to interceptions, which is the greatest sin a wide receiver can commit. You don't know where he's going to be at times. You know, he's raw. He's very raw, but he's worth developing, no question about it. I mean, he has a chance to be a really good player, and I'm curious to see how he looks going up against Xavier Rhodes, last year's first-round pick at cornerback. Rhodes will not shadow Benjamin because Rhodes only plays right cornerback. The Vikings, Mike Zimmer likes to keep his corners on one side of the field.
Consistency.
Yeah, and that's just how he plays. But when Benjamin is over there lining up on the offensive left side opposite the right cornerback Rhodes, I can't wait to see the battle because Rhodes is one of the few guys in the league who can match Benjamin's sheer physicality and I think take away some of those possession type catches that Benjamin's capable of.
You can match 6'5", 240?
Can't match it directly, but Rhodes, I don't know what's
to hinder it in some way.
Yeah, I mean, you can be cornerbacks are not going to be as big as wide receivers, but their techniques and the way they play, they have a chance to compete and be physical back with them. And Rhodes is one of those guys. I'm looking up his size now. My guess, he's 6'1", 210. That's
not bad for a corner.
You're right, but that's smaller than I would have guessed. I would have guessed 6'2", 220. So he's an inch and 10 pounds smaller than I thought. But it doesn't matter. He plays with strength, and he plays with an understanding of how to use the boundary to his advantage. And something like the boundary, that doesn't have a lot to do with a guy's size.
Andy, you once said that the Dolphins were the best defense in football, gave up 39 points to Denver, including 22 in the fourth. You said that. That wasn't
I didn't once say it. I said that last week.
Over 200 yards rushing. Explain yourself. Is it still the best defense in the NFL?
Okay. No, it's not. It's not still the best defense. But my explanation, let me ask you this, and Twitter trolls, listen up. I'm asking you too. If Miami's not the best defense in the league, and I still think they're a very good defense. They did not play their best against Denver. They obviously, their defensive line did not show up the way it usually does in run against the run. I don't expect that to be the case moving forward. It's the body of work's still more impressive than, you know, the setbacks. Let me ask you this. If Miami's not the best defense in the league, then who is? Who has the best defense in the league?
I'd go Buffalo or Seattle.
And I think you could argue San Francisco.
San Francisco's right there, too.
Detroit's been there all season long. They just gave up a bunch of points, though, but they've been there all season long. New England's on the rise. Denver's probably the most talented. Some have told me Cleveland. I've gotten Twitter people saying Cleveland, and I think that's worth – I don't agree with it, but I think it's worth a discussion.
Yeah, losing Gibson, and then Joe Hayden's been on and off
year. Yeah, but, I mean, we've just listed – we've gone through six, seven, eight teams right now.
There's a lot of good defenses this year.
Yeah, or there aren't any great ones. I mean, it's
– fair enough.
So it's the idea – and so what I was wanting to do with that Miami article, and I do believe – I did at the time that they're the best defense, and I believe they can, if you made me defend that, I could – I'd feel comfortable having to defend it because I think there's a discussion about who the best defense is. I think it's worth talking about. Arizona's another one you could argue. Miami has answers to those questions. They did not play well against Denver. I don't think it's a referendum on them as a defense. I think they had a bad game, and now it's time to bounce back. And, oh, hey, look who they get to play against.
The
not
Jets.
A bad team to bounce back against.
But no easy games, Andy.
That's right.
If you've taught me anything on this podcast.
I start to get the sense, you're right, the Jets just beat the Steelers a few weeks ago. I love, if I were a defensive coordinator, I would love to play against Michael Vick right now, though. I don't. He's not the same kind of runner. He doesn't make smart decisions with the ball. He sees things slowly and late. I'd love to play against Michael Vick.
Happy Thanksgiving, man.
Yeah, thank you, John.
Hey, remember to subscribe to the MMQB podcast on iTunes. Get it in your inbox every Thursday morning, or if you did it already, you'll get it on Wednesday. I'm John. He's Andy. We'll get you next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.